Deluge and Disaster, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Tropical Storm Harvey has driven tens of thousands from their homes in Texas, but help is on the way, including from across the border in Mexico.
We stand by Texas. We are friends, we are neighbors, and we will continue to be. And I'm sure that they know that we are with them and that they expect our solidarity, and we are happy to give a hand in these dire straits.
Plus, back-to-school clothes shopping in Soviet-era Moscow.
When the shipment would come in from, let's say, Warsaw, Berlin, or any of the Warsaw-packed states, there would be a huge line of people stretching for blocks to get something.
And that something was usually ill-fitting clothes in drab colors. It's back-to-school Soviet style, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Unprecedented and beyond anything experienced. That's how the National Weather Service is describing the devastation unleashed on Texas by Tropical Storm Harvey. Torrential rains and sustained winds have left thousands without shelter. At a press conference this afternoon, President Donald Trump praised first responders and called for unity.
We are one American family. We hurt together. We struggle together. And believe me, we endure together. We are one family. To the people of Texas and Louisiana, we are 100% with you. We're praying for you. We're working closely with your leaders and officials. And I will be visiting the impact zone tomorrow to ensure that you're receiving full support and cooperation.
Relief and rescue efforts are underway, but it looks like the crisis is far from over. Dr. Samantha Montano is an emergency management expert who's been following the situation closely. Dr. Montano, how are relief efforts going in the Houston area?
So relief efforts are currently ongoing in Houston and the surrounding areas. Primarily, the efforts are focused on saving lives right now. The Coast Guard, first responders, urban search and rescue personnel, and volunteers are all out doing those rescue operations right now. So it's definitely a process, but people are out there working on it.
What needs to be done in terms of long-term recovery efforts? We always hear, yeah, the storm's one thing, but it's really, you know, the months and sometimes years afterward that the hard work starts getting done.
Yes, disaster recovery is sometimes referred to as kind of the second disaster. A lot of people just hear about the response and the life-saving efforts that go on. But like you said, the recovery takes months and in this case will take years. Houston and the surrounding areas are going to need a lot of support. The federal government will certainly be providing some aid, but there will definitely be a need for nonprofits to be involved in these communities for the long term, addressing a variety of needs as they come up.
What about infrastructure needs? We're seeing incredible flooding. Does that point to something that the area needs that doesn't have?
So when we think about preparing for disasters, they're the things that we do months and years in advance to prepare. At a city level, this includes things like making emergency plans and exercising those plans. There have for many years been discussions about the risk that Houston faces. This is something that has been well documented. It is definitely something that's going to need to be addressed. There have been multiple flooding events in this area over just the past 2 years alone. And the repetitive flooding certainly suggests that this is going to be a long-term issue. There definitely is a need to make sure that we're building infrastructure and homes to a level that can handle flood events.
Are there lessons from other parts of the world that FEMA could learn from? Meaning, is there an example of a disaster recovery that was done really well?
Because of the difference in scope and scales of different disasters, it's difficult to compare something like the Haiti earthquake to a smaller flood event in the U.S., right? They're totally different scenarios. The size and scope of those disasters are different. Who's going to be involved in the recovery process are different. That being said, despite different countries having different approaches, One important thing to do during recovery is ideally implement mitigation measures into that recovery process. So an obvious example when it comes to flooding is the Netherlands. They've worked really hard at preventing a flood like this from impacting their community. So kind of taking that mindset that is used in the Netherlands to make their communities sensitive to the environment that they're living in and take substantial efforts to mitigate risk is something that we could really work on doing in the U.S.
Emergency management expert Dr. Samantha Montano. This next story takes us about 200 miles west of Houston to a bus station in downtown San Antonio. That's where dozens of immigrant women and their children found themselves stranded as Harvey approached on Friday night. They were left there by officials from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
They routinely take women and children to the downtown bus station because these women are connecting with family members or sponsors who are ready to receive them as they go through the asylum process.
Rocia Gunther is with the Rivard Report. That's the San Antonio News website that first reported the story about these 50 women and their children.
So they've been granted asylum and they're ready to go. But due to the storm, a lot of those bus routes were canceled.
So ICE officials presumably knew these buses had been canceled because of the storm, but they dropped them off anyway. Once they got there, did ICE do anything to provide shelter for these families?
So ICE actually released a statement after the story, and they're defending their actions, saying that all of the individuals had confirmed tickets and itineraries, but they declined to comment whether or not buses were or weren't running at the time of arrival. And so there were actually volunteers from a nonprofit. They immediately contacted city officials in San Antonio to see where they could shelter the women who were left there stranded with their children. And the city, in a matter of hours, they opened up some space at a local church, and the women were taken there to safety.
And you spent some time at that local church talking to these women and children. Give us a sense of the scene there.
So in addition to the women, there was a lot of homeless individuals there drinking some coffee, getting warm. It was rainy and windy that day. The women and children were in the third floor in a sort of playroom at the church. And a lot of the women there seemed very tired from their journeys. They seemed very exhausted. And, you know, these women have gone through a lot. A lot of them are fleeing incredible violence from Central America, gangs, violence throughout the journey. One woman that I spoke to, her name was Isabel. She is originally from Cuba, and she said she went through 10 countries since November. She said she went to Trinidad y Tobago, Venezuela, and then she went through the jungle in Colombia, and then Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico. And she finally made it to the border. She did this journey with her children and her husband, and they were separated at the border once they were taken to these detention centers. She was separated from her family. So once they were reunited, she was very happy to be with her family, but she was also happy that she was no longer at detention centers and she was, you know, finding refuge in San Antonio.
Did these people you spoke with, were they spending several nights at this church?
So actually, some people still remain there because in San Antonio, a lot of the bus routes were connecting to Houston. There are still around six families that remain at the church awaiting how to connect to their destinations because right now Houston is overwhelmed and they've seen unprecedented flooding. So things are very bad over there. So these women are still receiving assistance.
Rocia, what about other groups of people who go through the process, are approved, and are given bus tickets to get to where they are supposed to end up? I mean, what's happening to them?
Right. Well, to my knowledge, what's happening now is they're keeping them at the detention centers. And, you know, they're trying to make sure that the situation is safe before continuing to transport these people to different destinations. So after these people were dropped off on Friday, we have not heard of any other drop-offs.
Rocio, in your reporting in San Antonio, did you get the sense that local, state, and federal agencies have been effective at communicating in Spanish to the very large Spanish-speaking population in Texas as Harvey was approaching?
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I've heard so far, a lot of those people are getting information through the Mexican consulate, and they're doing an effort through social media and their website and everything to tap into that community. And of course, our stations here like Univision, Telemundo, they're doing a great job informing people and keeping them updated. But I think the immigrant community in San Antonio, especially, they're very wary. They're very nervous. And all over Texas, people are afraid to seek help or talk to law enforcement or seek shelter because they're afraid that they'll be asked about their immigration status.
Rocio Gunther with the Rivard Report, a San Antonio news website. Thanks, Rocio.
Thank you so much, Carol.
And coming up later in the show, more on how Mexico is helping. I'll speak with the Mexican Consul General in Austin, Texas. As the country waited for Harvey to hit the Texas coast last Friday night, President Trump started a storm of his own. He pardoned Joe Arpaio. Sheriff Joe, as he's known, is the former Maricopa County Sheriff in Arizona. He was found guilty last month of violating an injunction preventing the profiling of Latinos. Arpaio was due to be sentenced in October. The president defended Arpaio at that press conference we mentioned earlier.
Sheriff Joe is a patriot. Sheriff Joe loves our country. Sheriff Joe protected our borders.
Trump continued.
I stand by my pardon of Sheriff Joe, and I think the people of Arizona who really know him best would agree with me.
Petra Falcón is with Promise Arizona, an immigrants' rights group in Phoenix. Petra, tell us about your reaction when you heard the news that Arpaio was being granted a presidential pardon.
We were here in the office. We had just finished having a conversation, and then I got a call, and of course, I just shrieked, because quite frankly, I still in my gut felt, okay, this cannot happen. A president cannot pardon a criminal like Joe Arpaio and not do some other things that I think are just as important, such as working on immigration reform. He calls undocumented people criminals, and yet he has done nothing to fix that broken immigration system. And at first thought, again, it was just a lot of anger because, quite frankly, we've worked a lot. We've worked a lot in the streets. We've registered a lot of people. We worked the Adios Arpaio campaign in 2012. We registered over 34,000 people that summer. We got them out to vote. There was a whole other group of organizations demanding that the courts investigate and put Joe Arpaio on trial. And, of course, he was found guilty illegally profiling individuals that he thought were undocumented people of color, and we ousted him in the court of law. That history is not going to change just by the pardon that the president has made. History will reflect poorly and badly that the president acted immorally.
The mayor of Phoenix, Greg Stanton, he tweeted that Arpaio is someone who illegally targeted and terrorized Latino families. That's pretty strong language. How accurate is it?
It's very accurate because he did. There was over 100, I think 170 individuals that he targeted and were not undocumented people, but just were people of color. He lost in the courts. He was found guilty of racially profiling, and the court ordered him to stop those actions, and he did not. And that's why he is no longer sheriff. That is why he was going to be sentenced on October 5th, and that is what we think is perhaps now not going to happen because of the pardon. But absolutely accurate. The mayor's tweet was absolutely accurate.
Looking ahead, there's speculation President Trump could end the DACA program. That's the government deal giving hundreds of thousands of young people work permits, undocumented young people work permits, and preventing them from being deported. What's at stake for these people if Trump does indeed decide to halt DACA?
What's at stake is that over 800,000 young people known as Dreamers, DACA recipients, with families, that they will go back to living a life of fear. They receive the DACA benefit to be able to go to school, to have a job, to have a driver's license, to fear not being deported. Many of them come from mixed status families, meaning that their parents are probably still undocumented. They will all be living in fear again. This is an opportunity for the president to really be a president and uphold the values of family. And I hope the rumors are wrong. I hope he's not going to do that. But we are going to continue to build political power in our communities, getting people registered to vote, getting them out to vote, having young people in the community run for public office that represent the values of the communities they're from.
Petra Falcón is an immigrants' rights activist from Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. It's back to school time, and for many fashion-conscious American kids, that means ditching old clothes to make room for the latest styles. But that's not a back-to-school ritual Margarita Gokun-Silver remembers. She grew up in 1980s Moscow. Like her classmates, Gokun-Silver was accustomed to shortages. And what she did find on the rack in Moscow stores was drab and uninspired, like the late Soviet-era school uniforms that girls like her despised. I asked her to describe that uniform for me.
Brownish dresses for girls and two aprons, a white one for festivities, like Lenin's birthday, for instance, and the black one for everyday wear. So basically, we all got dressed up with a little collar and sleeve ends.
What are sleeve ends?
We had to have a sort of white cuffs and white collar, and you could buy factory-made ones, or if your grandmother could sew them or could knit them, then, you know, that's what my grandmother did. And you had a bow in your hair if you're going into the first or second or third grade. And off you went. Basically, that was it.
If you went to a department store or a store in the 1980s in the Soviet Union, what kind of clothes would be available to buy? Just give us a sense if for a teenager in the Soviet Union in the 1980s.
Well, teenagers, we were desperate. There was pretty much nothing that we liked. I mean, you go into a store and most people would go to a groom department store in Moscow. There were large department stores on Red Square. And they were all dark colors, all sort of misshapen kind of dresses. And there were no pants, I believe. I think all the pants that I owned, I actually made for myself. There wasn't much. When the shipment would come in from, let's say, Warsaw, Berlin, or any of the Warsaw Pact states, there would be a huge line of people stretching for blocks to get something. And my mother even said, well, it doesn't matter if your size is not available anymore. You just buy another size and we'll adjust it. So basically, you get it and you do whatever you can with it because that's something that you could almost never get.
And you write that you got your ideas from foreign-made clothes. Where did you get those ideas from?
Well, we especially used, there was this German magazine called Burda Moden, and it was very popular among Soviet women. At first, it was smuggled in, but then I think in 87 or 88, Gorbachev's wife, Raisa, brought it to Russia, actually, and they started publishing it in the Soviet Union. And so they would smuggle it in when I was making clothes with my mother. It was just the beginning of the 80s. And one magazine would just change hands in any organization where your parent worked. And you'd bring it. My mother brought it home, or my dad. And we would copy the patterns that we liked and then spread them out on newspaper, cut out the patterns, look for fabric somewhere, something similar to what the model would wear in the magazine, and then just spend days making.
And you usually only had the copy of that magazine, Burda Moden, for a couple days, and then you'd have to give it back because somebody else wanted it. And so during those few days, you'd sort of frantically draw up a pattern?
Exactly. Several patterns. The ones that you really like, the ones that you think you can make, you'd copy them quickly in a couple of days. And then my mom brought the magazine back to work and it went to the next person in line. They had a list as to who gets it. And yeah, that's how it worked.
And how did you get the fabric?
Usually Soviet women, when they had to find something, either toilet paper or soap or toothpaste or fabric in this particular case, they would do it on lunch breaks. And so they would queue up if there was fabric that was similar to what we saw the model wear. I think, you know, if it was polka dot, she'd try to get polka dot. And then we would just use that fabric. And the funny thing was, I remember one time, I think I made a pair of pants and we used a specific plaid for my pants. And then I met somebody in a metro wearing the same exact pants. So basically that same person had the same pattern from the Burda Moden, bought the same fabric, made the same pants.
And what do you remember about making those clothes with your mother?
There was always tea. There was always jam made by my grandmother the summer before from the fruits that we collected at our summer house near Moscow. And it was always, you know, just quiet conversation. We talked about school. I think we talked about, you know, the politics, maybe boys at some point as well. It was just this quiet time where we'd sit together and make these clothes and just kind of connect.
Why do you think these clothes that you made with your mother have such significance for you?
Well, on one hand, they were fashionable. So I got to actually look fashionable on the streets of the Soviet Union, and there weren't that many people who got to look fashionable. And it was just a moment that we shared together with my mother and also with my grandmother. On the weekends, we would get together with my grandmother, and we were all very close. And also just having made something, and I remember these moments when we would finish it and I would try it on and we would iron it, and then I would just hang it in my closet and it'd be just like new piece of clothing that looked great, that looked good, that I made. It was this feeling of completing something.
Now, you were inspired to write this piece because you were getting ready to do back-to-school shopping with your daughter, Eliana, and that's a whole different experience. I know your daughter is 17 years old, and she's right there with you. Can I talk to her?
Sure, yeah.
Hi.
Hi, Eliana. I wonder, you know, you've been listening to this, and when you hear your mom's stories about how she went about building her wardrobe as a kid, what do you think?
Well, I think her way of getting clothes is much more interesting probably than my way. However, I don't know if I would have the willpower to make clothes as she did.
How do you prepare for back to school shopping? I mean, do you go with your mom or do you just kind of go out there with friends and buy clothes?
Basically, just throughout the whole year, mostly in the summertime, I go with my friends. I'll go with my mom, sometimes with my grandparents, and I'll just buy things that I see other people wearing that I like. Yeah.
When you hear your mother talk about it, is there any part of her story that you're envious of?
Well, I don't get to spend as much time with my mother all the time because I go to a boarding school, so I don't see her as often. And I think it's really sweet how she got to spend time with my grandma making clothes, because I actually think that's a really good way to bond. And although I'm not sure I would be very good at making clothes, like finding a way to bond with my mom like that would probably be a good idea.
Eliana, have you seen any of the pictures of your mom in those clothes?
I have, actually.
Can you imagine wearing any of them?
Well, I mean, I know that like styles from the 80s are coming back into fashion now. So there's actually a few items of clothing that I have from my grandmother that are in my closet that sometimes I wear. And I just think they look really cool.
Eliana, do you think you'd have the patience to sew your own clothes?
To be honest, I don't really think so. But I mean, if it's a moment I could spend with my mom, I guess that would be good. So I could try.
Margarita, your daughter doesn't have the skills that brought you and your mother so much happiness. How do you feel about that?
You know, just like my parenting is different from my parents' parenting, you know, we create our moments of connections. Like we actually go through her closet and we eliminate clothes that she no longer wears that either go to charity or elsewhere. So we find our ways to create connection, but yeah, not through sewing, unfortunately or fortunately.
Margarita Gokun-Silver is a writer and an artist living in Madrid. Her daughter Eliana is 17 years old and about to head back to school. Thanks so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. Kenya's got a plastic bag problem.
You are bombarded by them, especially on your way to some of the most beautiful places. And I look at it and I feel bad. I always felt bad when I see it. It's a personal assault.
But this environmental activist is celebrating today. Find out why, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston.
This is a landmark event. We have not seen an event like this. You could not dream this forecast up.
That's Brock Long, administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, describing Tropical Storm Harvey. Officials say it's already the worst disaster in Texas history. And it's not over yet. Forecasters are now saying Harvey may double back to the Gulf of Mexico and pick up even more moisture before heading inland again with even more rain later in the week. We can't yet say for sure whether climate change has played a role in the epic flooding in southern Texas, but we do know that this is what the future looks more and more like as climate change contributes to a growing list of weather-related disasters around the world. Catherine Mock is a senior researcher at Stanford University. She focuses on climate change risks and how countries and communities can respond to them. Professor Mock, what do we know about how climate change is increasing the risk of natural disasters around the world?
What we see very clearly is that our emissions of heat-trapping gases are driving up risks globally. If we look at extreme heat, for example, the heat waves in India and Pakistan, China, Europe, Africa, the Americas, in almost every case now, we see that our emissions are making the events more intense or longer lasting. And the same goes for extremes around rainfall, droughts, and floods.
What are some of the places that have already been especially hard hit or especially vulnerable?
Today, I think many of us are thinking about the Gulf and the U.S. Southeast. And I think what is striking is just 1 year ago, extreme flooding happened in the Louisiana region around Baton Rouge. And our emissions of heat-trapping gases made that flooding more intense. Same goes for the flooding increasingly happening around the U.S. Southeast, where you have rain falling on top of a high tide and flooding streets.
Now, you're in the business of assessing these risks and trying to help people around the world anticipate and respond to them better. Are there any success stories out there, places where they're really taking this growing risk seriously and responding well to the challenge?
We see many different locations around the world that are transitioning from planning, evaluating what the risks are, moving into action. And I think a really compelling example of this is New York City after Superstorm Sandy. And that event in many ways was a trigger for building back better, thinking about everything from flood insurance, retreat among some communities, raising up boilers in hospitals so that critical infrastructure is safe, and even reimagining what the cityscape might look like so that it's more resilient. We see examples of countries being very ambitious. The Netherlands, for example, has a top-to-bottom risk management approach. France, for example, had an extreme heat wave in 2003 with profound consequences. They put into place many early warning systems as well as cooling centers. And then in 2006, they did a lot better. But what's also striking is that ambitious action on climate is not just in the high-income countries. Bangladesh, for example, has been very compelling in its responses to cyclones, developing protective structures so that they can raise up livestock and keep them safe, and also tapping the power of communities to provide early warning when a storm is coming.
Those changes you mentioned in Bangladesh, have they had any real impact?
Yep, there are a lot of comparisons you can make before and after, whether that's looking at some of the events that had very profound mortality consequences and how they did better, whereas other areas in the region still had very high mortality. So a big theme in adaptation is that not all poor people are vulnerable, and not all vulnerable people are poor. That's something we've seen in that example of Bangladesh, where they've been very responsive in terms of preparing for cyclones they have experienced and will invariably experience into the future. We also see it in terms of community-based adaptation across the African continent. Some of the most ambitious city-scale action, for example, has happened in Durban, South Africa. We see communities in terms of agriculture coming together to think about what does that mean for planning for increased risk of flooding in some places, increased risk of drought in others, and communities that are already more on the margin as compared to what we experience here in the U.S.
Now let's look at the flip side of that. Are there places that are either unable to respond well because of a lack of resources, or maybe they have the resources and knowledge, but they're just not implementing them?
The biggest barriers to adaptation look really different from place to place. In some places, it's very much financial capital. Do locations have the money? In other cases, the barriers to adaptation are more social or ideological. For example, not paying attention to the way that risks are changing, even if the scientific capacity is there to evaluate them.
What's an example of a country that's like that?
Well, here in the U.S., President Trump just rolled back an Obama-era effort that was to take into account flood risk for federal infrastructure. That kind of backsliding is not smart management or ambitious management in a changing climate.
Catherine Mock is a senior researcher at Stanford University. People on the small island nation of Fiji know the effects of extreme weather and climate change all too well. Scientists say that warming ocean temperatures are a factor behind changing weather patterns in the South Pacific. That includes cyclones with greater intensity. Reporter Sonia Narang has the story of a woman farmer hit hard by one of the worst storms to make landfall in Fiji's recorded history.
I meet Sunila Wati at the farmer's market in the town of Rakiraki. It's almost all women selling fruits and vegetables at rows of wooden tables. Wati arranges green beans and pumpkins at her booth and waits for customers. Today happens to be the festival of Holi. But underneath this festive appearance, she and the other women are struggling to survive. In February 2016, an extreme cyclone hit Fiji. Wati's home was among 30,000 that were destroyed.
The roof and things in our house flew away. The water flooded our home and ruined everything. After the storm, the mud and water rolled down from the mountains in landslides and destroyed our farms.
She tells me how the cyclone turned her life upside down in a day.
Before the storm, I used to grow everything. I planted cabbage, coriander, lettuce, and eggplant. But the cyclone turned my farm into a muddy jungle, and I'm not able to farm anymore.
In desperation, she and other farmers turned to local aid groups for help. One organization offered her seeds that were supposed to grow in harsh conditions. But the new seeds were no match for the heavy rains that continued to fall long after the cyclone. Wati says locals are used to lots of rain, but they've never seen so much extreme weather at once.
French bean ke bia mila, khira ke mila, tarbuj ke bia mila.
We received seeds for French beans, cucumbers, and watermelon. As soon as we planted them and they started growing, the floods came and swept everything away.
It was devastating, but she was determined to get back on her feet. She was willing to try anything. So she started buying vegetables from other sellers and then reselling them at the market. But she's finding it really hard to make a profit.
What I'm buying, I end up selling at the same price.
Now we have nothing. No money, no profit coming in. That's and very expensive vegetables we're buying.
So Neela Wati used to have a decent middle-class life. But she and the other women farmers here are now living on the edge. Every day, she wonders how long she can survive like this. She even thinks about trying something completely different.
I thought of taking lessons and becoming a cook. It kept coming in my mind, but I decided not to think like that. I want the business to be like before.
But it's not like before. The women say the market used to have lots more hustle and bustle, and the extreme weather keeps coming. Scientists point to warming ocean temperatures as a factor behind stronger cyclones and changing weather patterns in the South Pacific. Wati tells me how in one recent flood, she slipped in the water and fell on the way to work.
3 days uske baad kaam market nahi aaya.
I couldn't come to the market for 3 days and lost a lot.
But she has a teenage son to put through school and tells me she'll keep trying no matter what. In fact, she hasn't given up on trying to farm again either, if the rains let up enough. It's been a way of life for women here for generations, and she misses it. At the end of the day, Wati pours coins from her fanny pack into a black money tin she keeps at the market. With scientists predicting more extreme weather for Fiji, Wati faces an uncertain future. Not only is the rainy season more intense, she says recent dry seasons have been much drier than years past and the temperatures hotter. And she dreads the thought of another cyclone like the one that destroyed her crops last year. And she doesn't know what she'll do if it happens again. It's starting to rain, and Wati runs outside to the curb to catch a packed bus back to her village. She waves from the window as the bus pulls away down the wet roads. For the World, Sonia Narang, Raki Raki, Fiji.
Support for Sonia's story came from the International Women's Media Foundation. Discarded plastic bags are a scourge in many places across the globe, but the situation is especially bad in Kenya. Plastic bags hang from trees and clog waterways. And in Kibera, a Nairobi slum, there are entire hills made of them. Wanjira Maathai, a Kenyan environmentalist and the daughter of Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai, says it wasn't always that way.
I grew up in a Nairobi where we separated bottles and cans and newspapers for collection. There were no plastic bottles for soda. We saved our glass bottles and returned them to the store and got our credit back. There were times when we as Kenyans actually did manage our waste much better than we do today.
Those times could be coming back because Kenya has banned plastic bags and it goes into effect today. Wanjira, this new law is amazing. I saw that anyone found selling, manufacturing, or even carrying plastic bags in Kenya could be charged up to $40,000 and 4 years of jail time. That's wild. Do you expect this will really be enforced?
It is a lot. I mean, it scares me, and I'm an environmentalist. I always try and avoid plastic, but it still is frightening to think of the penalties. But I think even more important is to think of it the other way. You just don't want to be found with them, and then you don't have to worry about the fines. I think it's more a deterrent than I think will be an issue of people lining up in court and filling jails because of plastic. I think people will just not use them and not carry them.
Give us a sense of just how widespread plastic bag waste is in Kenya.
It's pretty bad. I don't have the metrics that would describe the volumes. For example, I've seen in many places, Costa Rica, for example, places where it is quantified. I don't have those metrics. But I know as a Kenyan, as a Kenyan who has traveled quite a bit around my country, you are bombarded by them, especially on your way to some of the most beautiful places. I, in particular, remember a trip I made to Lake Nakuru National Park. And literally, as you're driving, or Lake Naivasha National Park, some of the most beautiful lakes in the Rift Valley, and that have, you know, the most dynamic flamingo and bird life in the world. And as you're driving to some of these places, the first thing that hits you is the amount of plastic that is lodged in the ground, on fences, and even on trees, as you said. It's just not who we are. And I look at it and I feel bad. I always felt bad when I see it. It's a personal assault. When you see that sort of plastic around in a place that it really shouldn't be.
This isn't the first time Kenya has tried to ban plastic bags. Why did the previous bans fail? And what's different this time around?
Well, I think the political will then may not have been as firm as it is now. I think we're seeing some of the most committed and dedicated political muscle behind this. I've seen the cabinet secretary express and answer tough questions on this issue. She's firm. She's not moving. She is literally committed to this journey. And this is something that we've hoped for many years. We've seen it happen in our neighboring countries, in Rwanda, in Tanzania. And many of us marvel at the beauty and the cleanliness of a city like Kigali. And so why not in Nairobi? We are much better than the menace of plastic that we see. So I'm really happy about it. I know it's a challenge. We'll manage. We'll walk through it.
What about in informal settlements? I mean, we mentioned Kibera in our introduction. Plastic bags are used for everything. They're sort of necessary. They carry things like small amounts of paraffin or coal. You know, people even defecate into plastic bags. I mean, how is it going to be feasible to totally ban them when they're so convenient and necessary in places like that?
Well, look, it doesn't have to be that way. There are alternatives. For generations, my grandmother didn't use plastic. She had a sisal basket to go to the market and carry her goods home. She was not wealthy. She was a farmer. I think it's extremely important for us to appreciate that, especially for a country like Kenya. We are blessed with tremendous heritage and cultural alternatives that we have just abandoned and taken on plastic. I think we will be all right. I think, and especially in informal settlements, we can begin to see the beauty of no plastic waste just hanging around. People will have alternatives to plastic bags. That will not be an issue.
What do you use when you go to markets or buy things?
I have sisal baskets. I have some canvas baskets always with me. And then if I go into a supermarket, for example, and I do not have any, I often ask for a carton. But I am known, even in the places where I buy my vegetables, the women who I buy from, they always know, don't give her plastic. She wouldn't take plastic. I have always believed that this day would come. So it is a dream come true.
Wanjira Matai is the director of the Partnerships for Women's Entrepreneurship in Renewables at the Wangari Matai Institute in Kenya. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Sunday, as Tropical Storm Harvey tore through Texas, President Trump took to Twitter. He tweeted, "With Mexico being one of the highest crime nations in the world, we must have the wall." And Mexico, Trump insisted, will pay for it. The Mexican response? To reach out and offer its full solidarity with those in Texas affected by Harvey, as good neighbors do in trying times, as the Mexican Foreign Ministry said. Carlos González Gutiérrez is Mexico's consul general based in Austin, Texas. Mr. Gutiérrez, classy act there. I wonder, was it hard to make such a gracious offer to help Texans just hours after President Trump took to Twitter to bother them about the wall?
Well, Texas is our main partner in the world. It's our main trading partner. Almost one out of three people living in Texas has Mexican blood in their veins. So I do think that it was only natural. We have done this before. We stand by Texas, and we officially transmitted that message following instructions from my government yesterday to the office of the governor.
You mentioned you've helped the U.S. before. I know that was in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. What exactly is your government trying to do to assist Texans with Tropical Storm Harvey?
Well, two things. We have 11 consular offices in Texas throughout the state, and we are trying to reach every one of the shelters that have been established in different cities around Houston to interview Mexican nationals who might have been affected by this natural disaster. We are helping them in case they need repatriation services. We help them with money for emergencies. We help them contact their relatives with ID that they might need. On the other hand, we are working with the Secretary of State of Texas and the Office of the Governor to see what they need. And based on their request, we will be very specific soon in terms of the offer that Mexico would be bringing.
I wonder what it's like in your position. You're representing your country, and then you kind of see these tweets, these regular tweets from President Trump about Mexico. What's your reaction when you see these negative tweets?
Well, we are in the midst of very important negotiations around NAFTA, but we don't negotiate anything through social networks or the media. The Secretary of Foreign Affairs has said very clearly that we are approaching this challenge in a very serious and professional way, trying to find a win-win situation for all partners. Otherwise, it would be difficult to reach any agreement. We are hopeful that we'll be able to find an agreement that will benefit all parties, not only the U.S., but it has to benefit as well Mexico and Canada. Those things are not negotiated through social media.
What's your impression of Texans in terms of their friendliness or graciousness on matters everyday or worldly?
My personal experience is that Texans are, the vast majority of them, are pretty comfortable with the ties that unite them to Mexico. They know the history that we share, and they are pretty comfortable with the heritage that we share. The vast majority of them believe in offering the possibility of immigration reform, regularize the situation of the 1.5 million undocumented immigrants who live in the state, because on average, at least in the case of Mexicans, they have lived more than 10 years in this country. So the vast majority of them are pretty welcoming, and as I say, the vast majority of them are pretty comfortable with close ties with Mexico.
Do you think that this tropical storm and the exchanges you're having with the U.S., do you think that this is an opportunity to kind of forge a closer tie and get beyond tweets?
Well, we stand by Texas. We are friends, we are neighbors, and we will continue to be. And I'm sure that they know that we are with them and that they expect our solidarity, and we are happy to give a hand in these dire straits.
We've been speaking to Mexico's Consul General, Carlos González Gutiérrez. He's based in Austin, Texas. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Finally today, in Mexico's seaside resorts, dolphin shows are all the rage. Tourists have plenty of chances to see and even swim with our flippered friends. You can also do it hundreds of miles inland in Mexico City, but not for long. Lawmakers in the Mexican capital recently passed a law that bans dolphin shows there. Emily Green picks up the story.
If you're not there in person to see it, this dolphin show at Six Flags in Mexico City could totally be mistaken for a nightclub. pop music booms across an outdoor amphitheater overlooking a small pool, and an MC pumps up the crowd. On this day, 600 people watch in amazement as dolphins leap and twirl in the air and swim across the pool with trainers balanced on their backs. Tony Aguilar came with his wife and 12-year-old son. He says it's a pretty good show and a great way to learn about the animals. For an extra fee of $70, you can get in the pool with the dolphins. For lots of people, it's a magical experience. Like 9-year-old Patricia Lira, who bubbles over with excitement as she emerges from the water. She says the dolphins are beautiful because you can sing and dance with them. And she's already planning her next trip back. But within 6 months, this show will be gone. Mexico City's Congress has not only outlawed shows with dolphins, but also therapy sessions with them and scientific experiments. The Mexico City lawmaker who wrote the measure, Javier Lopez, says the dolphins don't live in acceptable conditions here. For starters, he says, the city is more than 7,000 feet above sea level and polluted. And the dolphin facilities that exist here, he adds, are little more than concrete swimming pools with chlorinated water. When the ban goes into effect, the dolphins won't be released into the wild, however. Dolphin Discovery, which owns the animals, will move them to one of its other aquatic parks. The company declined to comment for this story. Supporters of the ban include Mark Palmer of the International Marine Mammal Project. He acknowledges the Mexico City law is just one step. It doesn't ban the numerous dolphin shows in other parts of Mexico. Even so, he says, it's a big deal.
Here we have Mexico City, one of the largest cities in the world, banning keeping these animals in captivity. It's a very potent symbol.
And there are others. France, for example, now bans new acquisitions of dolphins and whales and outlaws breeding them in captivity. And in India, the government recently sought to protect both species by declaring them non-human persons. Dolphin and whale shows are still legal here in the U.S., but Palmer says the number of shows is on the decline. For The World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
And that puts a wrap on our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.